Okay, this is Nick Egan saying, whenever you get the chance, listen to What Difference Does It Make? Keeps you in touch with the past and keeps you back in the future.
Well, thanks, Nick, for that introduction. And you are, of course, tuned into the What Difference Does It Make podcast. Joined, as always, with my partner, Holly. We're going to start talking about videos. Nick directed some of our favorite music videos from the 80s and 90s. And we're going to talk a little bit about the ins and outs of what goes into making a video and what made these videos so memorable. So let's get started. Your first video for Real Wild Child. I watched it yesterday. There is a very quick shot of a woman wearing a Nevermind the Bollocks t-shirt. Did you throw that in as like a nod to Malcolm, like a thank you? Or is that just...
I think what happened with that, I was given the footage from the Ritz. They played at the Ritz. So it might have been an audience member. I can't remember. I have to have a look at it again. I haven't seen that video for a long time. I don't think so, David, in all honesty. I think if anything happened, it kind of happened accidentally because I didn't really know what the hell I was doing when I was making that video because I'd never done anything before. And I was trying to do graphics on it and I wanted to distort the images. And I took some photographs. I'd done another photo shoot from blah, blah, blah. But it was, I literally landed in LA and was given that job because I did the album cover because they needed it out quickly. And I was lucky because, and I say this a lot, the first thing you do is really important to what you do eventually. And I was really lucky that my first record cover was The Clash. The Clash is White Men and Hammers Pele. My first album cover was Texas Minute Runners, which is an iconic thing. And then Bow Wow Wow. My first video was with Iggy Pop. And you can't, they're difficult to argue with those in terms of selling yourself to people because, they're considered influential. So I wasn't conscious of that at the time. And I wasn't conscious of where I sat with the culture that I was involved in. In those days, and as opposed to now, you really had to go out and be in the world. You had to go and circle. You had to go and network, if you like. You had to go and meet people. You had to put your profile. Whereas now you do all that with social media. You couldn't do that then. You had to actually be out and meet people. And I still think I was recently invited to Nike do an inspirational speaker program where they invite people up to come and speak to their staff on their campus. And I was invited to do that. And I went up there and I talked to these kids who basically have got everything that I didn't have in terms of when I was younger, nobody invited me to come, someone like me to come and talk to them. They bring the world to these people who sit by the computers. And I said, I think it's great you've got the technology and the research you've got at your fingertips. That's something I never had. I had to go to a library. You've got this. And I think that's a wonderful thing. I said, but biggest inspiration, I think, if anything, is meeting people. And this generation seems to be so loath in doing that. They'd rather text than speak on the phone. They'd rather email than go and have a meeting. They'd rather, and I said, I meet people, all kinds of people, and people are still the greatest inspiration. You'll meet people that you have no clue what they're about, and then they'll start telling you things, and then you'll go, oh my God, what an incredible story. So meeting people, I think, I was thinking about you and I, Dave, and how that we met under these things, and neither of us knew anything about what each other did, but somehow we got this connection, and then it took us to this point. That would never have happened, I don't think, if it was just based off of being on social media. You can really pick and choose who you want to meet that way. You can't pick and choose who you want to meet when you go out into the world.
That's true.
You bump into that.
One of my favorite pictures that's on your website is you're at the, I guess it's the Boy George's birthday party in the 82.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Paint that picture for me. I'm kind of curious as to what was going on at that time.
You know who took that picture?
Please tell me.
Andy Warhol. It was at Mr. Chow's in New York. We were having dinner at Mr. Chow's, and Andy Warhol was a really loved George. When I first moved to New York, I saw Andy Warhol walking down the street, and I flipped out. I'm like, because he was my favorite artist when I was at school. He was my favorite. And my girlfriend at the time said, oh God, you know, that's nothing. Andy Warhol's everywhere. And she was right. I mean, Andy Warhol literally was wherever you went to. And he never said much. He was very much a voyeur, Andy was. And he always had that camera. And he took that picture. And I guess it ended up in Interview magazine. But there was his goddaughter, Kate Harrington, was the fashion editor of Interview magazine. And she said, oh, I want to do, they were doing this thing about music. And she said, I want to do an interview with my friend Nick Egan. He's an album cover designer. And when she showed the interview, he said, I know that man. I see him everywhere. He said, that's great that he does something. Because obviously he realized most people in New York didn't actually do anything. I did something. So he said, oh, I'd like to do something special for him. And Kate said, well, he loves your work. So he gave me this book. And he's signed his name all the way through, and he's drawn big hearts and love Andy Warhol. So I've got this fantastic book. It's probably worth a lot of money now, with Andy Warhol writing all the way through it. But that, when he took that picture, he didn't know who the hell I was. I just happened to be sitting with Boy George. George in New York had a birthday, and it was like he had one at the Limelight. Mr. Chow's, it went on all night, this party. And so, and I, because I've worked with George, I did a couple of his record covers and designed his logo. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I was one of the people he knew in New York before he moved there. We used to go out all the time together and stay up late and yeah, have a lot of fun. And that picture came up, I don't know who posted that picture. I think George put it on his website, actually. And then Mark Jacobs also retweeted it. So yeah, so that's so it goes beyond just the photograph. It goes on that Andy Warhol took the picture. Anything else? I was thinking, there's this friend of mine who lives in New York, and her name's Oberon, and she and I went to the 50th anniversary, recently went to the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, because Duran Duran played there. And her and I said, we should do a two-man show, because you know, she knows Chris Blackwell, and she comes from London too, but I said, we should do a stand-up together called The Art of Name Dropping, because when I say it to people, I think I'm name dropping, but these are people I know. And so it'd be like me saying my next door neighbor's name, but he happens to be Andy Warhol. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And we thought that was a really funny idea, the art of name dropping, that yes, we name drop. That's because we're involved in that circle. And we're both quite funny, but that's so we're thinking of doing this two-man show at some point of in a funny way of the things that we've done and the accidental things we've kind of bumped into. But and I'll tell you, and just to emphasize that point, when I was working with Bob Dylan and he was in LA, we were at Dave Stewart's. Dave Stewart was having his party. And as I'm talking to Bob, and George Harrison walks by, and Bob stops George and goes, George, you know Nick? Nick, this is George. And I just said, you can't really beat that, being introduced to George Harrison by Bob Dylan. That was brilliant. That wasn't lost on me at the time. You know, that was, you know, this is weird. Bob Dylan's introducing me to George Harrison. And George Harrison said, hi, Nick, how you doing? Obviously, you have to have, there are moments when you go, shit, I'm in the middle of something really, really big here. And this is like, I don't know what this is, but this is an important moment. But you can't get too involved with that. You've got to think about it. You've got to put yourself on. Yeah, because I'm impressed with some of the people I've met. I tell you, the person I've most been impressed ever meeting, though, was a guy called Tom Kenny. Do you know who he is? He does the SpongeBob SquarePants.
I was about to say, that is the SpongeBob guy. We've talked about him before.
His kids were at my kids' elementary school. And at the school gala, he was there. And I went up to him and I said, oh, my God, it's so great to meet you. I said, my kids love you. I said, in fact, I love you. And he turned around to me and he spoke to me in SpongeBob's voice. And that to me was one of the great, to me, that was, I was more impressed with that than anything, any other person I've met. Just, and the fact that he talked to me with the SpongeBob voice just blew me away. So
he's also in a band. He's a rock artist. He's an artist. He's a musical artist too.
He's a great guy. And he used to come to the school and read stories to the kids. I was thinking how lucky those kids were. But that, and I could quite honestly say, the reason why was because I was a fan was because I wasn't involved in his world. Mm-hmm. That was a different world that I knew not that much about. And the SpongeBob, me and the kids still watch them to this day because they're so brilliantly funny. Mm-hmm. So that was the only time I really, at the moment, was why I felt like I was stuttering to him, you know. and he was great. So yeah, I think some of those people that I've come across has been on a professional level, and you have to sort of maintain a professional sense of what the situation is. Their lives are constantly bombarded by people wanting to talk to them, and I think that's what you have to be when you become in the public eye. But I also get the fact that once in a while you don't want to be talking to someone that's just idolizing you. You want to be able to talk to somebody on a one-on-one, and that's why I've had to, from the very beginning, had to really look at it, everything I've done from a professional point of view, when I look back on it, I'm more impressed about what happened than I am at the time, if you see what I'm saying. Obviously, I couldn't not be impressed by some of the things that and some of the people I've met when I look back on it. But at the time, you have to look at it from a purely normal point of view as much as you can. Yeah, but yeah, I'm lucky. I mean, I have worked with some of the best bands that have been around. And even if they're not the most successful bands, it certainly are, like Sonic Youth, you know. I did 2 videos with Sonic Youth, and they were just the greatest people to work with. And I saw them play at the Hollywood Bowl not too long ago. They've never changed their sound. They don't add strings. They don't do remixes. That is a cacophony of a wall of sound. And I thought, is it going to work at the Hollywood Bowl? But it did. It was brilliant. Did you see it? And they played the Hollywood Bowl?
No, that must have been, they broke up like 5 years or a while ago.
Yeah,
I've seen Sonic Youth before, and they were in a small club. But yeah, that's the bowl, that would be pretty amazing.
I thought that they weren't going to pull it off. I thought they were like very much going to be a small club type of band. But no, it just was one of the best shows I've ever seen, because it worked in that environment. And what you love about them, or what you loved about them, was they stuck to what they did. And it took me a while, when I did Youth Against Fascism, to even figure out if there was a melody in there somehow. Yeah, and I was like struggling a little bit with the song, because the song didn't blow me away. But over the test of time, it really, you really get it. And I get why they were so beloved by people, was that sound.
We're going to take a quick break, and we will be right back. Enjoying yourself, Holly?
This is so awesome. I have so much more. There's so much more to cover here.
Okay.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shout It Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things Kiss. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these 3 EQ options, because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon. Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment of Protein Plus meal plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions, and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Welcome back to What Difference Does It Make with Nick Egan, our special guest.
you were at the precipice of Alanis Morissette's ascension to, to like, I mean, you ought to know, just launched her. That was like a Beatles moment, you know, like that was a moment, but apparently not a big fan. Or what was the, what's the story behind all of this?
Okay, well, that's a, that's an interesting story. And
break my heart here.
Yeah, see, Holly is a huge Alanis fan. So.
I'm going to tell you something about that after and about the video after, but yeah.
Okay, well, what happened was I was I'd done a video for Madonna's label. What was it called again?
Maverick.
Maverick Records. And I did a group called Candlebox. And Gaius Theory was the... Gaius Theory was the sort of A&R person over there at the time. And I knew him because I made a video with a group called Concan, and Guy was one of the extras in it with this guy called Bronx Style Bob, who was like, who was close to Guy. And so years later, when Guy was just this snotty-nosed kid, became this kind of like big A&R person, he always remembered me and he asked me to do a video for Candlebox, Far Behind. And it was right the whole Nirvana, Seattle thing, and they were sort of riding a little bit on the Seattle bandwagon. So I did a video for them and it went massive. In fact, I think it was the most played video on MTV that year.
Probably.
And so along came Alanis Morissette, and Guy said to me, we've got this new artist called Alanis. Would you do a video for her? So I kind of did. And there's a personal thing comes into this, because what happened, I'd just broken up with the mother of my first child, Roman. And she had been brought in as a temporary person to work in the music video department of Maverick. And so I didn't want to have anything to do with her. So I kind of tried to say I wasn't interested in the video, right? I didn't want to do the video. But the guy kept on and on and on, and he wanted me to meet Alanis, and I met with Alanis. And I saw what she'd done before. She was this bubblegum kind of like mini-skirted Canadian pop star. And I didn't think she had too much credibility. And she, and you know what? She was blooming at that point. She had teenage acne and she had a mono brow. Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, she just didn't look like she was going to work on film. So I kept trying to pass on it. And then in the end, I said, oh, I'll just test it to the limit. I took a piece of legal paper and I wrote, I want to do the Alanis video in Death Valley. She will look good. And that was my treatment for it. And they said, okay. So we go out to the desert, and my crew for the first time said to me, and I didn't, to be honest, I just knew we'd go to Death Valley. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I had no idea. And my crew kept saying to me, what are we doing? What are we doing? As we went, we're setting up in Zabriskie Point, set point, whatever. And one of the people on the set, a friend of mine who was a photographer, Michelle Larita, had this little suitcase. And there was that time when those little cat stickers, I don't know if you remember those cat stickers you get from those little vending machines, those kitty cat stickers.
I think so.
And she had them on this, and I said, that's it, I've got it. Because when you listen to the lyric, I hate to bug you in the middle of dinner. This was an 18-year-old girl who had not recently lost her virginity. And she, I guess to this guy, was a 36-year-old guy, and she took it really personally that to him it was nothing. You know, to her it was a big deal. So I thought that line to me, I hate to bug you in the middle of dinner, was ironic, because actually what she really, she did want to bug him in the middle of dinner, and nothing was going to stop her from doing this mission wherever it was. So now I saw this Terminator type of character, this aggrieved woman who wanted to go and have it out with this person. Nothing was going to stop her. She would walk the entire length of the nation to get there. So this suitcase was this metaphor for her, where this is where I get her changing. You know, she stops and she changes into another outfit and she keeps walking and then she's running and then you end up in the most spectacular part of this country, which is Death Valley. I've got an obsession with Death Valley anyway. But she's in the middle of Death Valley and she's walking and she's coming to sing. And I started cutting, and I thought, you know, we shot it on Super 8, and I thought, oh, you know, out of nothing, I've made something. I've made this story. Super 8 made it really easy to move around, so we didn't have to get locked into shot lists. It was really, let's do it over there. And we had the Rangers with us were helping us out to get to places the normal public couldn't get to. And then when I did the final edit, she sent a note and said, oh, I love the edit, Nick. I've just got a few changes. So I went to her little house when she had this little bungalow in Santa Monica. And then she proceeded to give me 20 pages of changes. And I'm like, hold on a second. I said, she goes, I want this. And I said, no, you know, what you don't understand. she goes, I want more close-ups. Now, the reason I didn't do close-ups was because her skin was bad. And she had this monobrow. And this, the way she was delivering the song was intense. Don't get me wrong, it was great. But it didn't make her look attractive. She was mugging, and she was pulling these faces. I didn't tell her that. But I said, you've got to trust me. I said, this is Super 8 film. It's not very flattering on close-up. I said, and also people are not going to want to see. Ironically, she did that video that was just a close-up of her face, which I thought was ironic after I'd just done that. I said, you can't have a – people are going to get – it's going to be too much if all you see is close-up. So we had this argument, and she was telling me she was right, and I was telling her I was right because I was the one that had the track record with me. I was the one that had success on MTV, and she hadn't done anything before except in Canada. And blah, so we had this argument about it, and then – she kind of insisted she was right. I made one condition to what she said, and that was the bit in the middle where you see the crossfades. That was her idea, where you kind of like go from, because I was all about cuts and not dissolves. And so we did this kind of crossfade thing, and I give her credit, that worked. So anyway, not too long after that, I saw an interview with her in the LA Times where she said, well, I didn't like the video very much until I changed it and made it work. And I was really insulted by that. So then a thing came up. It got, I can't remember where it was, but it was put down as the 10 most influential videos of the last 25 years. And that video was in it for the reason being the way it changed the perception of women in rock music. Up until then, most women were considered just like a titillation to a video. And even the scene, this is the first time a woman rocked out as a front person in the video. And it ended up being the inspiration for the Lilith Fair, and all these things came as a result of it. And that's why it was. I personally never liked. I wasn't a big fan of that video. I had better videos. I liked more, like the Oasis videos. And so they came to me at this TV station and said they wanted to do an interview with me about it. And as I was finishing the interview, I said, "Does Alanis know I'm doing this interview?" And they said, "No, not yet." I said, "I bet you when she finds out I'm doing it," because she wasn't going to do it. I said, "I bet you when she finds out I've done it, she'll want to do it." And sure enough, she did. And she did this thing where she said, "Well, Nick wasn't very happy with the ideas, but I think what I said improved the whole video," which was just bullshit. And it just shows you the cult celebrity, because they took her side rather than my side on it. And actually, I'd say 90% of that video is everything that I did it, and 10% of was her idea. And I've seen her since. I saw her at a friend's wedding and we kissed and made up, and you know, but she will never admit that that was a video that really broke her career. And I did it. It's just funny because I didn't give a shit about it. I didn't want to do it. I tried everything I could not to do it. I even to the point of writing a treatment that had no information on it at all. It's just like, I want to go to make a video in Death Valley. Alanis will look great in it. And it turned out to be one of my most successful videos in terms of what it did. I would be interested to know what your viewpoint on it is, Holly, because as I said, it was considered on this 10 of the most influential videos because of what it did for women in the place of music. So what was your thing you were going to say?
That's exactly what it was. Who was Alanis Morissette? Because I heard the song. I was working for a radio network at the time.
That's great.
These hit discs, you know, with new releases for the week. And that was the first time I heard the song. And I went gaga over the song. In my early 20s, you know, had a huge impact on me. So of course I wanted to hear more by her. But then when I saw the video, first of all, I thought the video was beautiful. I love the color. I loved everything about it. But it's funny, it left me hearing the story now is so great, because it left me wanting to see more of her.
Right. Okay.
And now I'm wondering, had I seen more of her in the video, more close-ups of her in the video, would I have felt differently? What kind of impact would that have had on me? But that video had a huge impact, because it did exactly what you're saying. Women in rock, and she seemed so powerful to me.
She was.
And I didn't know at the time. I didn't know a lot about her. I hadn't
researched. Well, nobody did.
I didn't know until later about her Canadian, you know.
Cheesy. It was very cheesy, that song. But you're absolutely right. And I think those things, those moments, you can never predict them, because I certainly didn't go out of my way to promote her as, who is Alanis Morissette? It was more avoiding her. I mean, there's a couple of shots you can see it, where she's really close to camera. It's out of focus. But you can tell she's pulling this really light face. And I thought, that's going to put people off. You're going to look at it and go, oh, my God. Not because she's a woman, just because it was way too in your face. And so I never planned it to be that way. I never planned any of it to be that way. I never planned it at all. That was the funny thing about it. All was like very off the hip. And it ended up being super successful. And then you can try and do that and try your hardest to try and repeat that, and you can never do it again. It just, it's one of those things that just everything kind of aligned to that reason, the reason that I didn't want to do it, the reason she wanted to have just close-ups, the reasons it was, most of it was shot from a long distance. And you know what? I'll tell you one thing, though, to give her credit, and I did give her credit for it because it was a great song. There was a moment, and I think if you look at the video, when she's in the salt lake flatbeds, the white, where she's in the white, she's got this white thing on. And we were shooting that. I think it's one of the first things we shot. And she was running and she was rolling on the floor. And I looked at my crew, had done every music video you could ever see so they could give a shit about music videos. Every single one of them's jaw was dropped. They were looking at that going, and I always remember that going, again, at that moment, this woman's got something. As much as I might not get on with her, at that point, I did get on with her. Just, I only didn't get on with her when it came to the edit. I got on with her great up until that point. But I just remember being with his crew, and I always look at my crew and see how they respond. And most of the time, they're doing other stuff, and this person's performing. But this one, every single one of them was looking at her. And I thought, that it shows that she's got something. She was an incredible, incredible performer. I mean, just her confidence, her kind of like, you would have thought she was doing that to save her life, the intensity she put into that performance. And she kept that level the whole time through the shoot. She maintained that level of like intensity. She's an intense person.
You can tell by her lyrics how deep, just, I don't think, yeah. I would want to get in there.
No, and I wouldn't want to be that guy that she wanted to bug in the middle of dinner. Let's just tell me that. I mean, that was the line that really turned it for me, because I just thought, I hate to bug you in the middle, it was such a sarcasm and such a, that's what got it to me, because I thought, that's exactly what she wants to do. She wants to walk in while that guy's having dinner with somebody else and cause a scene right in front and not give a shit. And I thought that was a brilliant thing. And that, in a way, was an empowerment of women, even though I think her motives were naive, because, you know, 18, being with a man that's older than yourself, you learn a quick, rude lesson about life, because it was important to her. She lost her virginity. It was a big deal to her. But to other people, it's just another day, you know. And the fact that she took that so intensively showed her naivety, but in a way also showed her strength, because she didn't care that people thought that. So I've got a lot of respect for her. I just think the way she slanted it in the media just bothered me more than anything else. Like, she was really reticent to give me credit for it, even though, I mean, she deserves credit because she was a performer. She was great. But, you know, I deserve credit for actually capturing that on film and pushing her to what I did by making up this story of her. This is what you're going to be. You're going to be like the Terminator. That's what I told her. You know, in the Terminator, you can't stop Arnold Schwarzenegger. He just keeps going and going and going. And that was what I put in her head. I said, you're the Terminator. You're coming across the country. Nothing, not the military is going to stop you from getting to where you're going to go. And she took that on and she did it really, really well. So, yeah, the other stuff was accidental, but yeah, it was great, powerful, you know.
I'm offended at that. I mean, about her, I, considering that video pretty much, I mean, the music also, but launched her into stardom.
And it's weird because if you look at all those subsequent videos, they're nothing like that. They're nothing like it. They're very slightly hippie, slightly, you know, she did that when she was naked, which I think was a big mistake with Stefan Sidney. She did the toe close-up, which I think is, yeah, it was interesting. I think that it wasn't the kind of video that she really would have done herself, but it was because I was so used to working with bands and I was so good at bringing out performance in people. And I think the record label convinced her that it was right. And she did everything. She was great when I was working with her. But I noticed that everything after that was nothing like your no. She never really rocked out like she did on that.
No, definitely not.
I think I'm sort of lightening up on, you know, because you do a job. There's been videos I've done and I've gone, oh, you know what? I didn't enjoy that. So I don't enjoy looking at the video. And that was one. I think I've sort of lightened up on that a little bit because of its place in kind of cultural history in terms of what it did. And I was, when I watched that program about it and the way people were talking about it and the way people were going on about what it meant, and then they were interviewing girls and saying that gave us authority and that gave us a place and that gave us power, then it touch me that I had been involved, because I'm a big, big supporter of women and equality for women and women in rock. And so to have had a part in that, because I always had as many women on the crew as I could get. You know, I was always close. My producers were always women. To have had that effect on women and yourself as well, Holly, is a proud moment for me to have done in the political sense of what I've done. You know, so yeah, I'm beginning to see it more and more from that point of view than I did from my own personal point of view. But thank you for saying that.
Oh, pleasure. But also, don't get me wrong, I'm a fan of the other, the NXS and Duran and all that as well.
Okay, someone asked me recently, when I did this interview with the Duran Duran fan website, and they asked me, you never really ever feel like you finish what you finish. You have to hurry up, you've got to finish your deadline, so you have to finish, you have to make compromises. The one video I've ever done, it's one of my most recent videos, it's the Duran Duran Pressure Off video. Because that was the first time of video. When I talked to Nick Rhodes about it, he said it should be like the NXS kit cover. So that was great. But it's the only video I've ever done when it ended up being exactly as I saw it in my head, exactly without anything. I've always seen it in my head, and it's always come out slightly different. Sometimes better, sometimes not as good. But that video was exactly as I saw it. And what I got from that video was every single shot in that video is an individual. I've never got them together in one place, and I had to shoot the band in London and actually shoot Nile Rodgers and Janelle Monáe in Los Angeles. And I've got to give Simon credit, because I said, Simon, you've got to play this like you're on stage with everyone. You've got to work, because otherwise it won't work. Yeah. And we gave him C stands as like, okay, this is where John is, this is where Nick is. He didn't need the eyelines. He said, you can take the eyelines away. And if you look at the video, you look at him, he looks over just when Janelle Monáe comes into it. And he looks over where John is and he makes it come together. And to me, it really got. And first of all, with Duran Duran and with any band, whether it's on album covers, the same with NXS, the reason I did the kit covers, because you can, if you take a photograph of five guys in a band, it's always going to be one that doesn't look very good, or two. and it's really almost impossible getting all five people to look great at the same time. But if you shoot them as individuals, which I did with the NXS cover, and then montage it together, everybody can look great in it. And that's what happened in that Duran Duran video, in terms of, yeah, Nick looked great because I worked on his individual shots. John looked great. So, and then when you put them together, and then you've got someone like Janelle Monáe, who's got such a great energy and so like she raises everything up to a high level. Then I go, I got the perfect, that was the perfect storm for me. It all really came, but it still had an influence of the 80s and the 90s in it.
One of my probably top 10 songs is Live Forever. And I love the band Oasis. Oh, yeah. And I'm sure, and the Gallagher boys are probably like, insane. I just need to hear what you must have. What are your impressions of the Gallagher brothers, or you know, like?
Well, the first time I went to see them play at the Whiskey, I got there too late because Liam had stormed off stage, so I missed that.
Then sounds
I went
about
for
right.
Dinner with them with Epic Records. They took me and them out for dinner. He goes, "Oh, we don't give a fuck what the story is." He goes, "The fucking video better be good. I was going to kick your fucking head in." He said, and then I worked with them. And they were really like naughty on that thing with the drug abuse on that video. But I kind of got something out of them, and it's based off the Bowie Man of Fall to Earth film, that whole video. I always have film references in the back of my head because I'm such a fan of films, and in particular Stanley Kubrick, and I love Nicholas Rogue and Federico Fellini, and there's always an element of those in there. But the Live Forever video to me was almost as good as it was almost the perfect storm in that one, because it's almost a perfect video, because I like to be ironic. I like to use irony in what I do a lot. And the idea of Live Forever said to me, well, people who are dead, like musicians, they live forever. Painters live forever. Filmmakers live forever. Actors live forever, because you can always see them no matter what generation it is. So I thought, well, okay, that's a good basis of it. That comes from a film called Performance by Nicholas Rowe with Mick Jagger in it, James Fox, where Mick Jagger is with Anita Pallenberg, is this kind of burnt-out rock star that lives in Notting Hill Gate somewhere, and it's all hippie and mushrooms, and James Fox is this Cray Twins type of gangster that is, in a way, is almost regimental, like soldier-like, clean, neat, and he comes into this world of mushrooms and drugs, and I thought that was a great sort of metaphor for the whole Live Forever thing, and I chose to put Mark Bolan, Brian Jones,
Jimi Hendrix,
and various Sid Vicious, all these rock stars. And in the original movie, he's got pictures of racehorses. So I decided to put these people in our culture live forever. And it was really tricky on that one because Liam did not want to act. Fucking hate acting, he said. I'm not a fucking actor. And the very last shot of the video is him walking off. I've had a fucking enough, and he storms off. So I left it in the video. But the interesting thing about that, it was commissioned by Epic, the American Epic Records, and the guy that was the video commissioner was with me on the set, was like, you know, Liam doesn't do anything. He just stands there. And he kept saying to me, you've got to get him to move around. You've got to get him to move around. I said, you can do that. I'm not going to go and tell this guy to jump around when he's obviously not known for jumping around. But he looks too boring. So what I have to give my credit to my editor, Nicholas Wyman Harris, the genius of that video is cutting to Liam when he's doing nothing. When he's not even singing, he's just staring. And I think that really pushed that what Liam was doing was cool. He didn't have to jump around. You know, he could move. But I did about six videos for them. I mean, Duran Duran and Oasis are the most I've ever done videos for. And they kept with me. They hate making them. I think the one I also did in Death Valley for Who Feels Love was one of my favorite videos because it just was stunning to look at. But I had a sort of camaraderie with them, and that was over, Dave, it was over soccer because they're Man City supporters. And we did a lot of talking about soccer, and, you know, I support Chelsea, they support Man City, and we'd have big conversations about that. I got on with them relatively well. They like to be contrary and they're sort of purposely negative. That's their thing. Mm. They hate everything, hate everybody, hate everything. We said, really, they don't. They just, it's just a big act, as far as I'm concerned. But no, they were, again, some of the best things I did. And I think Live Forever really does stand out to me because that was the video that really broke them in the States. I did Supersonic, but then I did Live Forever, and Live Forever was the one that they got the buzz clip on MTV. I mean, this is when MTV were like, if you got it on MTV, and I remember the head of Epic calling me and saying, you better guarantee this is going to make it on MTV. And I said, I can't guarantee anything. It's like, it's not down to me. But it did. And it got the buzz clip and it really broke them in America. They never made it as big in America as they could have done. But that certainly took them over into the next level, really, that video. I look at it and I go, I'm very proud of it. It came out second to the Duran Duran video in terms of how I saw it in my head, you know.
The top for me.
Anything else?
Let's talk about where you are now.
I've been doing a lot of artwork. I've been doing a few videos. I worked with this fashion company called The Superb, and I shot a promotional video for them. It's on the website, you know. I've been working with Mindy Hebert, who was the chairman. She was the president of the Grammys when I was on the board. I was a governor at the Grammys for 2 years, and she was the president. And her and I, she's a preeminent jazz sax player in the world, female jazz, and I was just working on a new album cover with her, and there's another artist who I was working to do a video with who was in a band called Fabulon, who I did a video 20 years ago. It was a brilliant song that never kind of made it, called In a Mood, and he's coming out with a new record, which is great. It's a brilliant sort of glam rock record, and I was about to do a video for him. So what I've been doing in the meantime is shooting miniatures. I've been making these miniatures and shooting the exteriors as miniatures. So yeah, I keep constantly busy. You don't get paid a lot of money like you used to anymore, but you keep busy, basically, in order to survive.
That's what we're all trying to do here.
Yeah, we're all trying to do. And at the same time, stay healthy.
Exactly.
You know? Oh, I'm always busy. You know, I've got a certain independence because I did a video for this girl, this Australian girl, which is also on my website. She's a wrestler, and we went out to the desert, and I used all my family to help me with that. My son was a camera, and my daughter, who's only 14, was a stunt driver, believe it or not. She drove a stunt car. I mean, you know, because we were down these desert roads, and my other son was helping with driving the follow car. So I've got them all involved in it, and it turned out to be a pretty good video. Yeah, and I get invited to go and speak at certain places and get a lot of interviews, so. Yeah. That's good. Keeps me relevant, I suppose.
For sure. That's why we want to talk to you.
Yeah, it's great. It's great talk. Yeah, it's really wonderful talking to you. But I really do appreciate what the two of you do. I've enjoyed this. I've subscribed to your podcast.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, Despite me being involved with it or not, I thought it was an interesting thing to have an access to. So, all right, so guys, so I hope it all turns out well.
Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you.
All right. So that was great. Thank you so much, Nick. I really appreciate the time. Great. Love having you here. This was wonderful.
Next time, if we do another one, it'd be nice to do it sitting down with you in the same room.
That's right. And maybe I'll see you on the pitch. We can, if you got a pickup soccer game or something, we could play. All right. Thanks a lot, Nick. Yeah. Thank you.
Bye.
See you around. Bye. Nick Egan, everybody. Well, thank you so much for tuning in. Make sure to follow us. You can find us at on our website, wddimpodcast.com. Facebook, it's WDDIM Podcast. Twitter, the same. Instagram, the same. We have a very active Facebook page. If you listen on Apple, hey, 5 stars, reviews. We love it all, of course. Until next week, this is Dave.
This is Holly.
Check you later.
Over and out.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Jabbers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.